Ladies and gentlemen, girls and boys, welcome back to the NBL Pocket Podcast. Firstly, if you're new to the show, subscribe so you can get the latest episodes automatically. If you like or dislike what you hear, let me know by giving a rating or review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify or wherever you may be listening. My guest this week is Boddy Nodge. I talk about with Boddy about his thoughts on The Last Dance, Michael Jordan and the Bulls. Boddy's been covering basketball for a long time in this country, including that period during the Bulls' run. So I got his input on what his interactions were with the Bulls and the NBA at that time as a journalist. We also talk about the new wage cuts in the context of the 41-year history of the league. We talk about the linchpin moments of the NBL wages and salaries, how and why they are the way they are, and the amount that they are. So we talk about that. We talk about the impact on the imports and high-profile players, who Boddy thinks will return for NBL 21, and what NBL 21 is going to look like, as best Boddy and I can surmise. We also get Boddy's thoughts on the Adelaide 36ers' new coach, Connor Henry, and in particular his three-year deal. And then we talked about the NBL as a product. In a different-looking league, will it continue to be the family product it is, or will it look to nourish its classic male 18 to 35 demographic? And how will it go about doing that with video and written content? And we talk about the history of books in the NBL. There's very few, but there are some. We talk about how and why they are the way they are. Really fun chat, sprawling along. Hope you enjoy it. We jump into this interview as Boddy and I are discussing his viewing conditions for The Last Dance.
I think the first thing I want to say is, what was your viewing experience? Like, were you quite ceremonious about it, or did you just put it on, had it on the background, or were you like focused?
No, I was totally focused because I have Michael Jordan obviously at the front of that conversation for the greatest of all time. But I don't overlook Wilt Chamberlain or Kareem Abdul-Jabbar in particular, who I personally thought was the GOAT. If you asked me, that's who I would have said. But I love Magic. I love Larry Bird. And now the conversation is only ever about Michael, LeBron, maybe Kobe. I don't know who's going to be next in the conversation. But I've always sort of thought, well, Kareem is the one. But Kareem was 7'2" and an athletic freak. And they don't come along all the time. But you look at a Michael Jordan at 6'6", perfect physique, does everything. Everything. Rebound, shoot, score, win games, defend, assist, make the right play. He is, if you were building a basketball player to be the greatest of all time, he is who you'd build. And so in watching those two episodes on Monday, in more of a ceremonious way than just in a passing way, I had a lot of reinforcement of all the things that I thought were great about him. And I don't think him getting on teammates is a bad thing at all.
This is exactly what I wanted to talk about, because I was watching, and it's unrelated, but in a way very related, I was watching Louis C.K.'s interviews with people who had anorexia, and he talks about how he had to, but was so mindful of what he was saying because he didn't want to enter into what he called the psychodrama, because you never know when you're going to inflame the illness or the psychology. And I feel like that was the same with Michael Jordan, where if you look at all the stuff that angered him over the years, a lot of it is either misquotes, half quotes, taken out of context, yep, or not the way they intended. So when I heard that, I just
bloody
sort of drew
media.
Yeah. And I just thought that's very interesting. And I think that's the case. And I see it with modern athletes as well, where they, in a way, manufacture or even concoct. And we saw it with Shaq when he had this sort of running thing with David Robinson, where he said that he didn't get a signature or something, which he had totally made up. Not a word of it's true. And I feel like that's where, and we find ourselves in this sort of sports media relationship that's kind of tentative. Do you see it the same way?
Yeah, but I think I love about Michael, and I think it was mentioned in the two programs on Monday, because I've read it before and I've heard it before, that, and I think even Luke Longley might have mentioned it, that Michael's attitude was always, somebody in this crowd may be seeing me for the one and only time, and I want them to take away a memory of Michael. I don't want them to say, yeah, I saw Michael Jordan. No, he wasn't that good that night. So he made sure he came to play 82 games in the regular season, every game of the playoffs, every game of the preseason. You know, like that, there was that mention of, or that piece on the fact that they went to Europe and played that. He played, he knew those people would be seeing him that was the one and only time. So he played out of his skull, naturally. And he did that all the time. Now, if the greatest player, arguably in the history of the game, is bringing you that every week, then he has a right, an absolute right, to expect that of his teammates. You know, if they're dogging it, he's got every right to get on them. Absolutely.
And I thought the same way. And if you've seen a film called Whiplash, have you seen that about the drummer?
Yes. Yes.
Because at the end of that, the teacher is actually the hero in a way. He sort of whittles down the stone to where this kid becomes the best drummer he possibly can. He's the villain for 99.9% of the film. And then at the end, they come together. And I felt like that's the Jordan story with music, where Jordan just whittles people down to the ultimate goal of getting their best, which is probably the best for them. So it's an interesting thing. And then, I mean, there's been a lot about like sort of mental health and workplace bullying and that. And we saw the way they treated Krause, certainly seemed to flirt with that. But, you know, sports are such a unique set of circumstances where,
exactly.
I mean, it's an all male profession, which first of all is out of the ordinary. You don't see that. There are very few professions that are all male, NBA anyway. So it's a whole different set of circumstances. So the whole conception of, oh, well, that wouldn't happen in my workplace, so it shouldn't happen there, is kind of a misnomer, I feel.
Yeah, yeah. And it's not as if Jerry Krause didn't create an adversarial situation by himself. He did that. So yeah, what other means has the athlete got other than to belittle him a little bit and try and bring him back down? Because, I mean, what he was trying to do and what he did, that didn't serve the organization long term in its best interest. So
I wanted to talk to you about like your relationship to Jordan and the Bulls in that year, in that 97-98. So I was at that age, I'm sort of 10 or 11. My understanding is fleeting and small. Were you covering it at all in Australia at the time or consuming? You know, I think there's maybe one game a week. Were you watching a lot and enjoying?
Yes, we were trying to watch as much as we could because back in the day, you didn't get to see a lot of NBA on television. You know, going right back to that Bird Magic era, there would be a Sunday morning replay hosted by Bill Palmer on Channel 7, and that would be your fix. And then as it wore on, we got a few more games here and there. And then, so there was a great interest, obviously, in what Luke Longley was doing from the Australian point of view. I mean, and we had other instances to him, and you'll see him now. They're playing him on ESPN quite regularly. The college NCAA finals where they drag out the 1989 one where Andrew Gaze was playing for Seton Hall.
Seton Hall, sure.
And back when that happened, when that was actually happening, Channel 7 was bringing that in live, which was unprecedented. So there were moments where the networks did seem to realize that basketball does matter to some portion of the population. But it was much later, much after Luke, that we were getting regular games. Like I think in the time he played for the Minnesota Timberwolves, I reckon we saw one game that he was in. That was a game where I think he got 22, I think he got his career high. So they showed that game. Here's Luke Longley, you know, doing this. But other than that, we didn't see a lot of Luke, just like I didn't think we saw a lot of Luke on Monday night either, just quietly. I thought he was forgotten man a bit.
I had this thing where, so I went back in preparation for this because I just got inflamed, and I went back and watched a lot of that season. And in particular, the game I keep talking about is Game 7 of the Eastern Conference Finals where they play the Pacers, and it's right on the line. And the refereeing is pretty interesting in that game, but that's another conversation. But in the last 5 minutes of the fourth quarter, it is just give it to Michael, get out of the way, or more than likely, it's a pick and roll at the quarter court mark, the same stuff you see today between those two. And I felt like if they don't go into that relationship, especially in that year, they're telling an inauthentic story from a basketball strategy standpoint. The Longley-Jordan relationship was a strange one. And even on the floor, it really was those two to the exclusion of everyone else at the end of games, especially in that one anyway.
When Luke retired, I asked him what he was going to be doing now in his retirement. I said, are you going to be making movies? And even as I asked that question, I thought, no, there's not going to be a lot of roles for a redheaded 7'2" guy. And he said, hey, hang on a second, I'm all over Space Jam. I said, I don't remember you in Space Jam. He said, yeah, that's me setting the screens.
He said, and he's his size and width is he can't teach it, and it's incredibly useful, certainly in that game, because the last sort of eight winning plays where Jordan either scores or gets a line is he's getting a pick from a guy who's, you know, this wide, yes. and you can't teach it.
Yep.
Let's jump to the NBL. This new deal, buddy, you've been around the league for a long time. What your first impression and thought of it?
I thought it was reasonable because of the circumstances. I mean, the world is undergoing an extraordinary situation. The world, it's not restricted to a couple of us or a few people or a state or a country. It's the world. So every sport is going to be impacted to some extent. And you've also got to look at all the businesses that are in trouble. And these are your sponsors, who are the people that are pushing money into your various clubs and things. So it's a very realistic, and the fact that the players' union has come a lot, you know, bought into it, because, you know, Jacob Holmes has the players' interests at heart 100% of the time. So if he's prepared to do this and say, well, if you're getting 200,000, you're going to have to go back to 50% of that, or, you know, and the other extremities that are there, well, you've got to think, well, for the survival of the league, they have to do this. So I think it's responsible, basically. But what it means, though, is the product will be diluted substantially. And then you're going to go, well, will we be getting the attendances?
Right.
You know, will we be getting the television coverage? Will you know, what is the other?
Just print interest, everything. Yeah.
Everything. Yeah. Mm. But then, in saying that, every other sport's got the same set of problems.
Mm. You know, I see it as there's a few positives for the NBL if you can. Under extenuating circumstances, the NBL may be able to capitalize on a few things, just where if other leagues take a hit, there's only 5 to 10 players on the court or on a team. It's a lot easier to manage if you need to sort of negotiate travel and so on and so forth. So there's a few things, but, you know, as you said, ultimately it's a, you know, it's a bit of a kick in the whatever.
Well, you know, there's talk of all Australian lineups. Now, there's only been one case in the history of the league, and we started long time ago, where an all-Australian team, there was not a single player on the roster that wasn't born in Australia, won the championship. Okay?
What team, what year?
1979, St Kilda. Right. They were all Australians. Okay? And that is the only time it's happened. The subsequent year, they brought in Rocky Smith. They
had one. I was about to ask. I was like, he's team.
Yep. So they went away from it. But that's the only team. So it would be quite an interesting phenomenon to have that occur. Could it occur? Is there a group other than maybe Brisbane? If you take the imports out of Brisbane and you retain the team that they had this year, would it be good enough?
I did a PER study into this, and it was a bit of a farce, but they're a pretty decent team on paper. Sobey, Glidden, Hodgson, Magne, Kadee. That's as good a local lineup as you're going to get. I mean, if you went with Terangi, if they keep Bacona. Him, by all accounts.
I'm just saying, he is. So, but I mean, just looking at the team they had, I'm just going on what they had last season. You take out, you know, you go, so who else could you do that with? What other team, if you took the imports out of Cairns, they're not making the playoffs. So if you take the imports out of Sydney, you take
New Zealand and Perth are the ones I like.
Right.
Perth, you've still got the best player in the NBL. And when you've got the best player on the floor of 10 guys, that there's a currency with that. And then New Zealand have actually a pretty good team of, like, if they've got Webster, you know, Tom Abercrombie, Delaney, Rob Lowe was good for them. But, yeah, I think you're right when you say it. Brisbane, and I think probably Perth secondly, they've got the best player. If it went to all local, they've got the best player, and that stands for a lot.
Now, here's the question. Would you as a fan want to go and see those teams?
No, I wouldn't.
Because I went to see the Adelaide Perth game because I wanted to see Bryce Cotton live.
Yeah, same.
I didn't really care about anyone else. Yeah.
No, I just wanted to watch him. And it was like, I felt embarrassed because it was like when you know, they do those ISO cams, we're just looking at one guy. That was how I viewed the game. it would be a real gut punch to lose him.
Yes.
Yeah, he's real special. I'll ask you the question. Do you think that's likely? 50% cut. He's at the top. He's 27 at the peak of his career.
Yeah, I think Perth will do everything possible to retain him, and they might therefore back end a deal. Say, you know, look, this is what we've got to do because of the circumstances. You understand that. But coming up in the following couple of years, we'll make it up to you in this way and that way, you know. So I think they've got options. I would hate to see him out of the league. Really, I would really hate to see him out of the league. There's not a player. There's not another player I can think of that we would miss as much as we will miss Bryce Cotton.
Nah, not even close. Machado was coming along quite nicely. Tell me, has there ever been anything in the past or recent past that's similar to this? Like, when was the last time players took there was a salary restructure in the NBL?
Around about the time when the league was about to fall over.
2009?
And then Basketball Australia came and saved it, ostensibly, and then moved back from 48-minute games, actually earlier, 48-minute games to 40, and therefore, you know, salaries, et cetera, had to reflect that. And then there was the period when the clubs pulled away from they consciously uncoupled from Basketball Australia, taking a leaf from Gwyneth Paltrow. And then briefly, again, there was the question of we have to try and survive. There was a period there where they only had seven clubs where Melbourne Tigers wasn't going to go on. And eventually the Tigers, the league called the Tigers bluff and they hung around and we had eight. Because you couldn't really continue with seven. Seven was
no. Then you've got half the teams making the playoffs of a number of teams you can fit in both hands. Yeah,
but,
count on both.
But also we had New Zealand. So what you're saying is, if we've got a 17 league, that means Australia can only produce six teams. I mean, it's not a league you're going to pay any attention to. Whereas now we've got the attention of the world.
Mm.
So it's an interesting scenario that we've got at the minute. Absolutely. But yeah, there have been times around, you know, through this 40 plus year history where there has had to have been attention paid to what players are being paid.
Absolutely. Would this be the most extreme measure that you've seen?
Yes. Yes. But it's the most extreme situation we've found ourselves in 100 years. So,
makes sense. Tell me a little bit about the history of player wages in the NBL. Are there any linchpin moments from the past that stand out as, you know, major moments where that has laid the groundwork for how and why NBL players are paid the way they're paid?
No, I think it's just been basically ownerships have tried to outbid each other and you know, some people have come in with programs that are unattractive, and therefore to make it attractive to draw players, they've had to throw a lot of money at them. Right. And therefore that has artificially inflated the market. Hey, look, I can get 120 grand over there. You're offering me 70. I'm going over there. Well, hang on, now we've got to up it. You know, so it was artificial. It's always been done. That's what happens all the time, unfortunately. And every time there's some restraint shown and the clubs get together and go, we've got to save the league. We've got to be together on this. They are for a year or two. And then someone says, you know, we need that player over there. Let's offer him a bit more money.
And away
it goes again. And that's human nature. And I don't think it's ever going to stop. But it's I don't know how realistic it is for our country. I mean, it might be realistic in the US, but it ain't realistic for us. Mm. You know, especially now with businesses in trouble too, with sponsors, potential sponsors and people that sink the money into you. If they're not able to do it, you know, you've got to be realistic about what you can pay.
Mm. Do you feel like this was, let's say coronavirus hadn't happened, do you feel like we were trending towards something like this, perhaps not as extreme regardless, not to this extreme regardless, where wages just had to come down?
No, I think we just perpetually run toward the cliff.
Yeah.
We just keep running towards it until we tumble over, and that's when it stops and go, okay, hey, we're in trouble.
Yeah.
No, I didn't see this. I mean, and you've highlighted the story in the Australian or the Financial Times about
John Stanshall,
about the potential financial issues for our league. But that doesn't stop people paying huge amounts of money.
Interesting. So you don't think, this is my next question, you don't think there's any sort of trickery, or I've got subversion, I don't know if that's a word for it, on the part of the NBL and the team owners to kind of use this as in a really rude way, say, use this as an excuse to lower wages, which they wanted to do anyway? You don't see it that way?
I would see it that way if Jacob Holmes was fighting him.
Yeah, it seems like, so I was surprised that players came to the deal. I thought we were going to see sort of a lockout or at least a delay of a decision, because, I mean, the season's not until October. There's really no definitive answer, yes or no, whether there's going to be crowds, which is how the NBL seemingly makes most of its money. So, but the fact that they were agreed to it so soon does suggest that there was an inevitability of what is forecast.
Yes.
You're right.
But you don't want to be a sportsman or sportswoman right now agitating for extra money when you're seeing what healthcare workers are paid, etc. You know, you want to just pull back and remember that you're just, at the end of the day, you're running around in shorts and a singlet. You're entertainment.
You know? I think the argument, if I was Jacob Holmes, the argument I would have had would be like, well, let's use, for example, a plumber. A plumber comes to your house. He does a fine job that's worth 10K. And you go, well, I know you've done 10K's work, but I can only pay you five. It's all I've got. The plumber would say, well, I've done 10K's work. And Bryce Cotton would be there saying, I'm a $200,000 a year basketball player. That doesn't change regardless. Now, that's the curt sort of cold response to the, but if you look at his production, that's where I kind of had this, caught between two minds.
Yeah. I don't know.
But what do you do? You're only good as your market.
Yes. I'm fearful for the season. You know, I'm very interested to see when it's going to be played, how it's going to be conducted. You know, we're in a very, very weird time in the history of the universe, you know, and our sport is just one of a gazillion things that has impacted. The question is, how badly will it be impacted long term?
I mean, I read an article today that seemed to suggest pretty strongly that Nick Kay's looking to return. Did you read that?
Yes.
Josh Garland, the West?
To play in Perth. Yes. Yeah. Yep.
That's good. Let's jump to Adelaide. Connor Henry, coached in this league, 11 years ago, 2009 with Perth?
Yeah.
They got eliminated in the first round, which is not customary for Perth, so they were probably a bit dissatisfied with that.
No, they're not dissatisfied. They can say, we made the playoffs. We made the playoffs 700 years in a row. We made the playoffs before Tutankhamun. The fact that there was an 11-team league and 8 teams made the playoffs one year, we don't worry about that. You know, I'd be a lot more impressed if they said we made the semifinals for 722 years and Tutankhamun can, go and toot his Carmen. But anyway, yes. So Connor Henry's time at Perth, I wouldn't say they have that in the vault as, the great years. No, I don't think so.
3-year deal. I mean, we've seen this with Joey where he signed, five? It's three for a first year. That's crazy.
That's crazy. That is absolutely. I'm thinking, didn't you just learn? You just signed Joey for 5 years, and after three, you couldn't wait to unload him. All right, yeah. So, I would have given Connor Henry, if that's the man you've decided is the right guy, 2 years with an option for a third that is the club's option. So he gets his 1 year honeymoon,
and gets his second year. Certain times.
Yep, gets his second year to produce, and you go, oh, we like him. We're going on for year three. We don't like him. We're getting rid of him. You know, but to just go in and go, 3 years, here we go. It is a long time.
The same thing, where it's like, okay, we've seen year one troubles, but year two is happening and year three is happening regardless. Toughy. Mm. 3 years. Rob Beveridge, my question to you is, who do you have to sleep with to get a coaching gig in the old team? How is he still on the shelf?
Well, I think he's still sleeping with his wife. So you know, as long as he's doing that, he's going nowhere. Sorry, Sue.
Crazy.
Look, he is the best coach out of the league. Now joined by Joey.
And he's close. He's in New Zealand. It's not like he's got a job in, some far flung country in the middle of nowhere. Like it's very, But sorry, but
I just think past managements haven't done him a lot of favors. When he's left, I think he's been wrongly painted as difficult, which he's not. I just think he will go to bat for his players, and when they're not getting paid, he will suggest that perhaps their performances might be being impacted by the fact they're not getting paid on time. They've got mortgages, etc., and then management gets pissy with him. It's like, well, okay. And so now when he leaves, I don't think he walks out the door with the pats on the back from management. He may get it from his players. He may get it from the crowd and the fans and the sponsors, but they're not the ones that, the GMs get together and they're chatting. Oh no, this guy's this and this guy's that. He's the best coach he should be coaching the national team in my view. That's what should be happening. Yeah. Forget all this other nonsense. We're now playing a lot of games, a lot of these Asia Cup, a lot of qualifiers that it could easily be a full-time job now. Previously it wasn't, but now it could be, and he'd be the right man. I mean, I'm still gobsmacked that Will Weaver was our national coach there, even briefly. I just can't come at that at all. I think that's an insult to every Australian coach that is coaching in the NBL or just outside it.
I mean, Will,
and that's with no disrespect to Will. He didn't make the ball. He just accepted a role that was offered to him, and good luck to him.
And at 35, I mean, I can't think. I mean, the average age of national coaches before that would have been a lot higher than 35.
Yes.
Or 36, I think, Will.
Yeah.
NBL Rewind. I don't know if you're over around this. This is Cam Luke and Liam Samaria. They're looking back at old games. I think they're going to do that. Well, Connor Henry's last game with the Wildcats, or the last game in the NBL. Is there any game?
That'd have to be a loss, wouldn't it? His last game? It'd have to be a loss.
It is a loss, yeah.
He didn't win a championship, so no, last game's a loss.
It was 09. It was the one where we really hit the 10 threes in the elimination final. Really good game. Really, really amazing game. Is there any game that if an alien came down from outer space and said, I want to see the best NBL game ever, do you have an answer to that question? Does one stand straight up?
No, that's too hard a question, but it would take a bit of time to think about it. I liked game 5 of the West Sydney Kings Championship Series. That was a pretty extraordinary series and a great finish with Ebi Arar going nuts. And I mean, that's got a bit of folklore attached to it. The Illawarra Hawks, I think they might have been the Wollongong Hawks, beating Adelaide 36ers.
Larry.
Yeah, with the 3 free throws at the end of the game, which was that. The thing that is that lost in that game is because of the controversial finish, that's all the focus. But that was just a phenomenal game of basketball. Have a look at the final scores and just, you know, there's guys doing amazing things in that game. I'm picturing Mark Nash on the wing, fakes, drives, throws down a dunk in traffic. Mark Nash, Nashy, what are you doing? Like these guys are out of control doing amazing stuff. It's a great game of basketball. And then it ends with that fantastic controversial finish. And I say fantastic because you want your league to have folklore and stories of games and situations that are phenomenal. That was pretty amazing. But yeah, I'd have to think a lot more because
they're the ones that jump out though.
Those two. Yeah, absolutely. They do.
Going back to The Last Dance, we spoke about at the top. Like, this is the first time I'd really seen Michael Jordan. Well, I'd seen him smoke before. He doesn't drink in this, but he has a drink. And this is really the first time I'd heard him cuss and the sort of cursing in conversation, which is different to, you know, yelling on the court. You can tell he's swearing at people in some of the highlights. You know, it's pretty obvious with the mouth movements. But in conversation, and it really got me thinking, do you feel like there's a stronger appetite for sort of mature, restricted content with sports? Like, I feel a little undernourished for sport content that's adult and not just swearing, but sort of in the way it's presented and also its subject matter. Like, what do you feel about that? Like, I feel like it's a very family friendly product, both NBL and A. And I feel like you can't be all things to all people. You need to have your family product, your kid product, and then also your target audience, which is males 18 to 30 who want a bit of SHIT and bit of bad. They want the bad blood. What do you think?
Yeah. Look, I think you have to make a program of that nature that's specific, that carries all the warnings so that kids don't watch it, or if they watch it, they know that they're at risk of hearing something. They, you know, their parents may not want them to hear. But generally speaking, because we are family friendly, that's why. I mean, I still find it absurd that when they come back from a timeout where a coach has sworn, that the commentators feel a necessity to apologize.
Yeah.
On behalf of the listen, you know, don't go in. If you're going in, if you've got that sort of access to go into that timeout and you hear what's said, then just say, geez, we're lucky to get that sort of access and move on. Don't go, oh, look, we're really sorry if anyone's offended. Well, then don't go in. You know, you can't have it both ways. Shut the hell up and move on. You know, we heard it and maybe we did. Maybe we missed it. Maybe we didn't hear it. Now you're bringing a highlight to it. So I think there's a fine line there because it is supposed to be a family-friendly product. But as you say, the demographic, the key demographic is not families in terms of who follows the sport, who are the people that are putting stuff up on you know, notice boards and forums, and it's that particular crew. So maybe they need a show aimed at them. I thought you had one. I thought you were kicking around a show.
Now you've got me started. Now I was just going to do
effing NBL podcast, wasn't it?
I was going to call it NBL After Dark and white, crisp white shirts with suspenders and smoking and drinks, and it's well off limits. And you know, cocktail waitresses. Like, I don't know if you saw the mayor of Las Vegas speaking the other day. Have you seen that?
No.
I'll send it to you. Amazing. She's Anyway,
is this one talking about She doesn't care about the casino. Yeah.
She's like, oh, we'll be a test. We'll be the placebo test of how many people die from coronavirus unprotected, which is, you know, probably what she ran on, the whole unprotected. but yeah, I feel like there's a market for that. And if you carry the warnings, do it at Watershed or whatever, I feel like that'd be hit. But that's not.
Well, why don't we start it?
We start it? We probably could.
Let's start now. Let's start swearing just for the hell of it.
And here's more something I had. Like critiques of players, you know, and criticism. It's very difficult to find that line because while it is obviously a public sport and a public profession, and I think players understand that, you know, how do you straddle that line, buddy, between criticism, critique, and, you know, maintaining relationships?
Look, by not being an arsehole. Okay, and I think a lot of our commentators want to make write that down. Yeah. Journalism 101: don't be an asshole, because I think a lot of people now are trying to make names for themselves in the media, names for themselves, and they're doing it at the expense of players. Oh, so and so should be ashamed, or you know, he shouldn't be getting paid tonight, or you know, this kind of emotional commentary is designed to get an effect for the commentator. You're either going to love that guy, geez, he tells it like it is, or you're going to hate him. Oh, wow, he shouldn't be saying that. But the reality is that that's not truth. You should just tell the truth about what you see, and the player can handle that. Now, on the Brad and Body podcast that I did with Brad, we were talking about Casper Ware's form through the playoffs. Now, you know, we know that Casper Ware is a great basketball player. And a clutch basketball player. So you have to examine what's going on in the game that is preventing him from being at his best. And you could see that he was very conscious of how poorly he was shooting. He was very emotionally connected to that. It affected all aspects of his game. You could see that. So that's what we talked about. We didn't talk about whether Casper's good, bad, or otherwise. We were talking about how the circumstances were impacting and where we felt perhaps the coaching let him down by not sitting him down saying, listen, let's just focus on keeping Bryce Cotton down. Don't worry about scoring. Don't worry about it at all. Yeah. Focus on just trying to keep Bryce to this or that and sort of take his mind away from the area where he was struggling. Put his focus somewhere else, and maybe that other area will pick up. It would just get open here and there. We'd just take a couple of shots. I'll make a couple. Get to the basket. Get to the free throw line. Oh, she's got 12 points. Feeling good about himself. So that I think is analysis, and the player can read that or hear that and accept it. But when you're saying, oh, he shouldn't get paid for game two because he was rubbish. Well, you're just trying to make a name for yourself, and that's where you're crossing the boundaries of mental health too. Now you might be impacting that young man because a bunch of other people are going to like what you said because you're being cruel. People like being cruel. They're going to jump on Twitter and other social media and attack somebody, and you're just destroying human beings. I see no merit in that whatsoever. I think if you made your reputation as a consequence of bad mouthing players because you can, that really reflects poorly on you.
Going back to that Casper Ware, I feel like it really showed. Like Dean Vickerman, the Dean Vickerman Mello Trimble issue is very similar to the Will Weaver Casper Ware issue, where like they both had a point guard who was a good scorer who was struggling, and I think Dean Vickerman seemed to handle that better.
He worked it out.
He worked it out. I think Weaver may have time kind of ran out on him a bit, yeah, that was the thing.
No, I didn't. Casper wasn't the same player in the semi-finals against Melbourne as he had been against them all season, and he wasn't the same player in Perth. I thought Will Weaver had ample opportunity, and I think he came up short. Sure. Because you're trying to get the best out of that player, and you didn't.
Yeah, I think that's pretty fair. The other thing I had was what was it? Oh yeah, like I feel undernourished for storylines as well. And I look at Casper Ware, right? And Casper Ware, if he returns, is going to be my. We talked about how much we want to see Bryce Cotton, and I certainly do. But the idea of, if I was doing NBL storylines, the idea of Casper Ware cast now perennially as the number two in the league, or you know, everyone's cut. The idea of him, can he claw and nip him and get it because they play the same position and stuff. I would. There needs to be next year's big storyline, if it happens, if they both play. I think it needs to be those two against each other. And you're either in the camp of, you know, I like to see dynasties and Cotton, and the best win, or I like to see an underdog, which Casper Ware is most certainly at this point. And I hope that we talked about family product. I hope that people can see that that's a really, you know, introduce a bit of that bad blood. It just, it doesn't make it swearing or X-rated, but it does make it that little bit more adult. And I hope stuff like that is brought in.
Yeah, because that's, I mean, basically you're using the analogy, I don't think you realized you were, but of the USA Olympic team from 2004 where they died in the butt to 2008. Yeah. So they went from the dream team to the redeemed team.
Right.
And it worked out. And that's Casper. He's had a pretty dream run with Melbourne United, won a championship, got to another championship series. He's had a dream run, and now next season would be his redeem season. Mm. Absolutely.
It'd be fun. It'd be the number one thing I'm watching for. That's it. The other thing I want to talk about is books. Gone through Marvelous. I've got about 3 pages of notes, which is a bit embarrassing. I'm still about 3/4 of the way through. I tried to get in touch with the...
Spoiler alert, he retires.
I tried to get in touch with the lawyer who represented, what's his name? Is it Kelvin Henderson?
Yes.
Yeah, I tried to get in touch with her. That's still, I've put that out in the feelers. I'd love to talk to her about that case and whether they thought they could win or not, because your book certainly portrays it as BA and the NBL was, you know, represented by a QC, and, you know, a QC is a high title, and then Adelaide perhaps not so much. So I want to know what their case in law was, how confident they were, if at all. Where did you see that?
I obviously the league didn't want naturalized players to be able to play ad hoc, you know, and in 1990 they changed the rules so that, you know, naturalized players could play at that time. You know, I think there was great. You see, you got to remember it's a different time. The one of the NBL's primary functions was to produce boomers back in that era. Okay, guys that were going to play for Australia. And there were great fears that if we keep allowing Americans to come in as imports and now as naturalized players and now as this and now as that, you know, that they're going to play the game for us and we're not going to be able to produce Olympic teams that are as good as what they need to be. Today, we pick our Olympic team from the NBA and from Europe and one or two NBL guys. Our NBL has no responsibility to the boomers Olympic and World Cup programs. It does have a responsibility now to the qualifiers. But that's only recently changed. So back in that particular period, that was the BA and the NBL were very conscious of not allowing Americans to come in and play the game for us. So they went at that with a QC. They absolutely had to win, you know. And then when they did, they held that against Adelaide for a number of years.
And I think when the terms, you know, human rights committee or, you know, the United, that when that gets thrown around, it's a big deal. Do you think that the right outcome was reached?
It depends what side of the fence you're on in that one. I actually now do. I think that's where we needed to be at that time. You wouldn't win that case now. But at that time, I think that was important that Australians were playing the game. You know, that we weren't just but now it's different. This is an entertainment league now.
Yeah.
The NBL. So I personally, I know this is going to sound radical, but I'd just go the way of the NBA. If you're good enough, and we'll recruit you. And there's no requirement for Australian, 8 Australians or 7 Australians. There's no requirement.
No. Right. I agree. And I think we've talked about this. Even if you don't have a salary cap or limitations on imports, the amount of money of your owner is what's going to stop the number of imports. No team's going to have more than three or four good ones at most. There's not the money flow through it. So the natural check and balance is there, I would think.
Yeah. But you know, I'd love to see Spanish players and French players, you know, Argentinians and Brazilians and you know, and Japanese players, whatever. I'd love to see them in the NBL. And we've got to stop then thinking of it as our league and a league that's important for development of Australian basketball, because it's still there for that. If you're an Australian basketballer and you're good enough, you'll get there.
And right? I feel like the NBL one could mature as that.
That's really the responsibility of NBL one and the state leagues in their, you know, their new NBL one formats. But that's their responsibility. When people talk about the NBL, you know, there's not enough Australian players. Oh, we've got 3 imports now and there's a next stars. I don't care about that. If you're a good enough Australian player, if you're Brad Newley and you're good enough, or you're Daniel Johnson or you're Nick Kay and you're out there. You're playing. You're playing your minutes. Don't you worry.
Some of them are in the NBL first and second. Mitch Creek. I don't know if you've spoken to Mitch Creek in the last little bit. It sounds like he was on the way to the NBA before he hurt his knee, first and foremost, and secondly, this coronavirus. It was a Western Conference team, and he said that at the time they were in discussions, so towards the end of the NBL season, he said there were three roster spots on this particular team. I've sort of looked at all those Western Conference teams. So already there's a 1 in 15 shot of guessing this thing. So 1 in 15. The team that has the least amount of rostered players is Golden State with 15. So I think the most a team can take is 15, and they can send a few guys down or whatever. And at that time, they would have been talking both Klay Thompson, Steph Curry would have been injured. So yeah, there's two roster spots, and then there's presumably a third. I couldn't quite work out the injuries, but do you think that's a safe assertion of mine that Mitch Creek was going to play for the Warriors?
Well, it's as good an assertion as any other. I have not spoken with Mitch about that. I spoke to Mitch about 2 months ago, was about right, the last time, but we had a chat. So well before any of this came out. So I really can't help you on that one. But that sounds like you may well be in the right direction, though. And it's not like Steve Kerr is not aware of Australian players.
Yeah, well, there was the Magne talk as well. So it's like there was definitely a radar there. You think Mitch Creek's an NBA player, right?
I think he could be an NBA player. Yeah, I think an NBA team could do a lot worse than pick him up. Do a lot worse. But then I also think Bryce Cotton's an NBA player. You know, there's a lot of guys running around that are in the wrong leagues because of circumstances, timing. Yeah, what that particular club they went to needed. I mean, you look at the Joe Ingles story. How good's that? Yeah. Yeah. You know, he gets cut by the Clippers. It looks like that's over.
Yeah.
Utah kind of reach out to him and say, yeah, at the airport. And he gets to go to Utah, babysitting Dante Exum, essentially. That's why they brought him in, to make Exum's transition easier. Exum's gone, and he's one of the primary players and has been for the last couple of years. So it's seizing an opportunity that's there. Now, Exum doesn't get picked up by Utah. Do they have the same interest in Joe? I don't know. Where does his career go then? And then we sort of say, well, Joe should have been an NBA player. You know, Mitch should have been an NBA player. Sam McKinnon should have been an NBA player.
Add another ribbon onto this story is, you know, you have, they take Exum, they presumably want Joe as a bit of a babysitter. They take in the year either with Exum or after is Bryce Cotton. Same position as Exum, loses out in those minutes because he's a better player at that time. More because I think they made the investment in Exum.
Yeah.
He was top three or five pick. You know, five, you can't five. Just go, oh, he's no good. Oh, we bungled up the top four. You can't do that. You've got to be like, no, he's our guy. We're all in.
You know, we love Terrence Ferguson. I'm not saying that. Yeah.
You know, you got to do it. So it's it's interesting how it's so you've got one and going the other way.
Yeah, there are a lot of players playing international basketball that could be in the NBA given the right set of circumstances, which they may never find. That may never happen. You know, and I've seen the same thing in our own league in the NBL. We had a guy here in South Australia named Jason Dix who won multiple Woollacott medals as the best player in our state league, 6'9", inside-outside game, really good. But I forgot what business he was in. I don't know if he was a corporate lawyer or something, but he was making more money in his working life than he could playing basketball. And he's a guy that would have been a very prominent, successful NBL player, but never got the opportunity and never pursued it with any vigor. You know, so there are guys like that in our own stratosphere. And so I don't have any doubt that if Mitch Creek got in the right environment, that he could have an NBA career. A lot of people, when Matthew Dellavedova came out of St. Mary's, were bagging the hell out of him. He's got the most ugly looking 3-point shot. He's got no athleticism. He's stocky. Nah, he's got no game. Never going to make the NBA. He's an NBA champion.
Yeah, exactly. Speaking of that, like I look at Terry Armstrong, Southeast Melbourne, and I think you know, people say, oh, the NBL Next Stars. I think his conversation is not really about the NBL Next Stars. It's about his agent. I haven't really looked at his agent. He's got about three different agents. I don't think the NBL was the right choice for him. He didn't play. Perhaps it would have been better served to go to Arizona. I guess my question to you is more about, like, the Next Stars. And you know, now that this new thing's come out where the G League seems pretty content to hang on to them and pay for them.
Yep.
Do you see that going the way of the Didi Luzardas, or do you see it taking on another inclination?
Oh, I don't know. Look, based on what they did with the Next Stars program this year, and Luzada is the prime example, then what you could say is when James Ennis played for Perth, he was a Next Star, really, because he'd already been drafted. And you know, he was already in the draft. So what are the rules? The rules started off fairly obvious that if you're coming out of high school, you need to play a year somewhere, you know, in college or internationally. Right, you weren't drafted yet. You were getting ready for the draft. Now we're taking guys that are in the that have been drafted. So what is, well, you know, like, I don't know, the NBL is going to have to keep a close eye on what the NBA is doing, but I think the Next Stars program basically has had the rug pulled out from under it.
I was about to say, do you think the NBA got a bit sort of like dirty? I think it was very much a, you know, okay, yeah, we'll play a few season games. You know, what can you do for us? We'll do for you. And then it's like, I don't think the NBA has a lot of interest in helping the NBL, and nor should it. It's its own product. It's not. Yeah. It's worried about its owners, its investors. It doesn't care if a league around the world does well or not. Yeah. And this was a moment where I think the NBL has got to look at itself and say, we want to have a friendly relationship with the NBA, of course, but not a servitude or a submission to the NBA. That would be a mistake.
Yeah.
And this was the first step to that, I think.
Yes. And so I'd be interested to see what form the Next Stars program will take going forward, but I don't see much of a future for it, to be honest.
Mm, no, that's same. Last question. Books.
Last I read question. Last. Can go and take a leak. Should not have had that cup of tea before I sat down. All right, let's move on.
Last books, like, are you reading anything preferably more basketball, sports related, or what was the last basketball book you read that you thought you might want to share with people?
Oh, the last basketball book I read was...
This is the one about the social league?
Not bad, thanks. By Graham Willingham. That's the last basketball book I read. Which is not sort of pertinent if you're wanting to know about, you know, NBA players or NBL. Yeah.
What about Jordan Rules? When did you last read that?
Oh, the Sam Smith.
Have you? Yeah.
A long time ago when it came out.
Did you think it was good at the time? Or do you think it's taken on a legendary status because of its subject matter? And
yes. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, my favorite book is still Breaks of the Game. I think we've talked about that. David Halberstam. That is my favorite basketball book. Haven't read it for a while. I might actually have to put it on.
He's got a Jordan book, you know.
I did not know that, no.
He did. He followed the Bulls in this season, 97-98. And it's my understanding, because I read about it on Amazon, is that the documentary thus far is very much following his blueprint, where I think in episode 2 they talk about the importance of that game against the Clippers, where they are 0-4 and they finally get the win, and Jordan really carries them. And that was a whole chapter in that book, and it's really taken that form. Jordan Rules, I've read it a long, long time ago. I certainly think it's elevated by its subject matter, but I'll read it again. It's a good book, I'm sure.
Yeah, yep. And there's another book I had, which I made the mistake of loaning to somebody, which was the story. Yeah, no, I know, never loan books. Anyway, I never loan CDs. You just don't see them again.
Or they come back scratched.
Yeah, it was about Jordan's years in Washington. With the Wizards.
Oh yeah, that one's by Michael Leahy, or Leahy or Leahy. That one's called When Nothing Else Matters, I think.
Yeah, I enjoyed but that.
You know, that had a very negative tone.
Oh yeah, yeah.
But maybe that was the story.
Yeah, I still enjoyed the fact that he was battling with injuries and bad knees and all kinds of stuff, and still getting out there and getting it done on a relatively consistent basis for an older man with no real help.
My last question on books, like, why haven't
you already gave me a last question.
This is like A, B. Why don't we see season journals of NBL? Like, was that ever a conversation for you to go, you know, cover the 36ers of 92 or whatever? I've never seen that. And was there a reason why?
Yeah, there hasn't been an audience for that sort of thing. Okay. You know, this is something that happens to me on a relatively regular basis, that somebody will come up to me, someone who's of some notoriety, and say, I'd like you to write my book. I'd like you to write my biography. And I'm always chuffed, thinking that's lovely. And then I say the one thing to them that ends it. And that is, okay, you come back to me with a publishing deal and I'll do it, because I'm not going to put in, you know, 6 months work, produce this thing, and then we try to peddle it for the next 2 years because nobody's interested. And that's really been, see, when I wrote Marvelous, that had a publisher on board. I knew that was going to get done. So I was writing it to certain parameters and no problem whatsoever. But that's why I did that book, and I actually am very proud of that book. I think I think we nailed it. But really, I would not have done that book. I mean, Brett came up to me. Brett said, "Let's go have coffee." Yeah. I mean, I knew him fairly well. I'd chronicled his whole career, mm-hmm. and we sat down. He said, "Look, I'd like you to write my biography." I threw it at him. I said, "Well, have you got a publisher?" He said, "Yes, we have." His agent was there as well. They had everything in place. I said, "You know, all we need is for you to agree and to do it." And I said, "I'm in." That was the end of that. And you know, it was. I wouldn't say it was an easy book to write, but it was a relatively easy process. But when you know it's going to get published.
Yeah, that changes the whole motivation.
So getting back to your second to last question, because I know there's going to be another one.
I'm bad for it. I will say that.
I think things like that there hasn't been a market for it. That's all. There is
because
now.
Of the pull of the NBL or just the pull of books?
No, the NBL. I don't think the NBL has had the profile that it necessarily deserved. Really, it hasn't. You know, and if you look back across the 40 years, you'll find only a handful of books written about it. You know, there's Boom, and
there's maybe five.
That's over a 40-year span. So now, tell me if there was any demand for it. You think there might have been a few more? So, as much as I like the concept of what you're saying, like a year of traveling with a team, you would have to get that published. You would have to sell that not as a year of traveling with an NBL team, but a year of an insight into a professional sporting team.
Yes.
It just happens to
maybe
be.
Maybe you widen it beyond NBL to people who are like, "Oh, what's it like with a team?" Yeah, maybe.
Yes. That was the only way. I mean, things might be different now, but again, now we're in that particular grey area of the coronavirus. We don't know what it'll look like when we come out of it.
Just the access. I don't think no team would sign on to it. I don't know. Maybe not.
I mean, I travel with the 36ers a bit, but I travelled with them to the McDonald's World Club Championship in Milan, and they went early and spent some time in Rome. And you know, I've got all my notes from that. It would make for a good book because there's a lot of funny stuff when you're funny.
I think that would be the more thing. You'd almost be
conversations
writing
on the bus. Conversations on the bus to and from practice, to and from games. Hilarious. I would just sit there listening, just wetting myself because you had real characters too, like Rupert Sapwell, Paul Rees, Martin Catalini. These are guys that are very droll, sort of Darnell Mee. Not got a lot to say, but when it comes, it's going to crack you up. You know, it was Mark Davis. It was a really, really good era to be with the group. You know, Paul Maley, who played for the Titans, who they knocked off in the final the season before he gets to go. He's feeling like all his Christmases have come at once. You know, we're standing on the corner in Rome, and he turns to me and he goes, "Hey, man, this is really cool."
I think there's something there, and I think you stumbled upon a title. I just sat there wetting myself.
I had a great title for a book back in the 80s when Bruce Palmer, he was bringing North Melbourne Giants here, and he had Scott Fisher and Tim Dillon and Ray Borner and David Graham, Wayne Carroll, that particular group, you know, big white guys, you know. And at that time, the 36ers had Bill Jones and Mark Davis, all these athletic Al Greens, and I sort of said to him, how do you feel about coming into Adelaide? You know, last year you came in, this, that, and the other happened. I just asked him a general question, and he says to me, "Buddy, this is a game between athletes and tractor salesmen." That's not the title for a book.
There's a title as well.
Athletes and tractor salesmen.
Flip a coin. Buddy, that is the last question. Thanks again. Always a pleasure chatting.
Thanks very much, everyone. That is all. A reminder, rate, review, and subscribe, and I'll see you next time.